This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the United States, and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World. Whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 FM is located, or the east side of New Orleans, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available to the show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Gary Oak, who I met in London, and he just got back from, are you kidding me, it's northern Syria?
Yeah, northern Syria, yeah.
Okay, I don't want to make a mistake here, Gary. Northern, what in the world, Wade's World, were you doing in northern Syria?
I answered the call to join a modern-day international brigade to fight ISIS fascism, and that call was made 2 years ago, and it was based on the news coverage of the death of a socialist from Germany whose name was Ivana Hoffmann. She was a gay, black, German socialist who had travelled to northern Syria, to the Kurdish region of northern Syria, to join other socialists and other progressives who were volunteers fighting ISIS. And when I heard about her, I couldn't think of a more inspiring example of internationalism that really put left-wing politics in the modern day, in the context that I understood. And so when there was a call after her death to form an international brigade...
Well, now, wait a second here. We're talking ISIS, the ISIS, you know.
Yeah.
The, you know, the
nightmare
for Donald Trump. I mean, who we're supposed to be looking after, you know, under every bed cover around the world for. This is ISIS you're talking about.
This was ISIS, yeah. Okay, so I suppose that's true. Yeah, I didn't...
Maybe you need to give a little more context before we get the whole international... Yeah. ISIS, you were going there
ISIS?
Whoa.
I suppose so... I can't say the first thing I heard about it was when this woman, Ivana Hoffmann, died. The first thing anyone heard about the region was ISIS. And you looked at ISIS and you thought, my God, what are we going to do about this?
World, because this is something we different from all of our experience.
Yeah, and the really disheartening thing about ISIS is they had a lot of international volunteers. They're people that come from my area of East London. There were kids that left their schools, their universities, their communities to go and fight for ISIS.
And that's true all over the United States, and Germany, and France, and everywhere else we're finding out where people just were looking to self-identify with something like this.
And now we know...
Why do you reckon?
I think a number of things. I think that... For the last few decades, we've had less and less firm values as society has been more marketized, and we have more of a consumer society, more of a service industry. And the left, which used to provide a lot of these values, used to provide our ethical basis, has lost its base, which was the industrial working class. You know, and at least in Europe anyway, we have automation, we also have capital flight.
We have a lot of automation in the US too.
Yeah. And what's happened is some things are good, you know, it's a diversity of things, which is it's very good to see ecology, it's very good to see feminism, it's very good to see intercommunal ideas of tolerance to become more to the forefront. But we've lost the basis of left-wing identity, which was about poverty, which was about inequality, it was about material things. And this is reflected all over society.
It's part of what's behind the rise of populism, as they call it.
Absolutely.
Classically, a populist was somebody who's committed to the people's welfare. Now, a populist is some... We were talking the other day when the New York Times has to do a whole article about what's the difference between an autocrat and a fascist. You know, things are way out of control.
Exactly. And it... is in this era of people not having these firm ideas of values, they're starting to look for people who seem to have it all worked out. And ISIS certainly said they had it all worked out. And that's one part of it. Of course, there's, you know, the experience of racism, especially in certain countries, you know, in Europe, with, you know, the proper ghettos in France and places like that. I wouldn't say there were really so many ghettos in the UK. It's probably one or two of the communities that, you know, ISIS recruited from quite heavily. But I wanted to confront this. I mean, we all on the left wanted to confront this. All of the people that went out there as volunteers, we wanted to say, you know, you think your values are universal. We think our values are universal. And we think that the people themselves can confront something like ISIS. The thing we really wanted to overturn was the idea that, you know, NATO, America, the American military was the people fighting ISIS, because that was a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, the reason that ISIS exists is because America started, the American military, I apologise, started something called the War on Terror, which actually created a war between them and Islamist terror, specifically Wahhabi, Salafi. We have to be very specific about who this is. It's not just, you know, the idea of some radical Muslims, Wahhabi Salafists, who didn't have much influence until the start of the so-called War on Terror. And so to break that cycle of the war...
Which was back in George W. Bush's term in the U.S. I mean, we have a current president, as you may know, who at different times has said that President Barack Obama invented and created ISIS. But it actually started coming forward back in the Bush regime.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The origins of ISIS were because of a bizarre policy after the destruction of Iraq, where the Sunni Muslims who had been in power were excluded.
Spend a minute on that. We're talking in, you know, the middle of the United States here. That's where people are hearing you. They hear Sunni, they hear, you know, whatever, Sufi, they hear whatever. So, you know, you've been right in the stuff, so might as well give them a minute on that too, Gary.
The most important thing to know is if you've watched the show Homeland, at least the first series, I stopped watching it after that, is completely inaccurate. They have this plot that Iran was carrying out, or was planning to carry out, these huge terror attacks. The people who do the terror attacks, they are a different kind of Muslim. They are different. There are two branches of Islam. There are Sunni and Shia. And Iran is Shia. And Shia Muslims are not involved in the kind of propaganda of the deed attacks on, say, nightclubs, you know, 9/11. All of those attacks are carried out by one particular branch of Islam, which is Sunni, Salafi, Wahhabi. And that is an ideology that was born in Saudi Arabia, which is a huge ally of the West, ironically, or maybe not, and is incubated in Pakistan. And the American government and the governments of Europe, they know this. They're well aware of who is responsible, but they deliberately let people say things like, say, radical Islam. So people are really concerned or confused about whole communities when you're actually talking about a very specific minority. I mean, if you look at Trump's Muslim ban and you look at actually where the major terror attacks, the Wahhabi Salafi terror attacks come from, they're nothing to do with the country.
Many people have pointed out that the fact that Saudi Arabia was not on the list, Pakistan was not on the list.
Yeah.
This has been, you know, grist for the mill in the United States now. Now, not long ago in the United States, there was a big sort of memorial, you know, nostalgia about the Spanish Civil War, where certainly there was time has been more friendly to the International Brigade there, where people came from everywhere to support the different sides in the Civil War in Spain. When you talk about an International Brigade, Gary, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
It's exactly the kind of thing. When I read the declaration, the invitation, should we say, to join the International Brigade, it said, as we formed international brigades to fight in Spain, we call on the progressive people of the world to join the international brigades fighting today in northern Syria, in Rojava, against ISIS. And if you grew up on the left, and I did, you live waiting to hear something like that. You really idolise the international brigadiers, you know? And I certainly did. I mean, I used to go to the International Brigade Memorial every year. You know, you learn the stories, the songs, read the books about them. And it pushed my buttons, put it that way.
And was this call made by Kurdistan and Kurds, or who were you fighting? When you say you're fighting, what do you mean fighting?
I mean, it was made...
Got the flak jacket and...
Nothing so deluxe.
Really like the Spanish Civil War, just, you know, sort of your sneakers and away you go.
Absolutely. I mean, didn't even have military.
Bring your own kit, and that's about it.
Well, you got issued a uniform, which was basically like pyjamas. It really felt like you're in pyjamas the whole time. They were paper thin. And an AK-47, and also a battalion or a group. A team within your battalion would have a heavy machine gun called BKS. We call it a Bixie. And someone would have an RPG, a rocket launcher. And that was
it. You got some training on the AK-47, or?
Yeah, we did, yeah. And away we went, you know. So the people who made the call were leftists from the region, so they were socialist parties, and coalition of socialist parties had travelled from Turkey. primarily from Turkey, but they also exist in the Kurdish regions. You know, Kurdistan is not an established nation.
Right, and this is probably something we ought to spend time. We're talking to Gary Oak here on Wage World today about his experience recently in the northern part of Syria fighting ISIS. And we're talking not fighting in a, oh my God, ISIS, we don't like your mama. This is fighting, you know, with pajamas and guns, it sounds like. So, Gary, the Kurd, Iraq, Turkey, Syria thing is right. Very complicated for people trying to keep up with it. But yes. You've done very well explaining some of these other issues. Clarify that for people listening. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, this was something I learned there. I went because leftists made a call to join an international brigade to fight ISIS.
And it sounded like you've been waiting for the call.
And I had. We all had. And we wanted to overturn the idea that, you know, there's the civilized world, which was so, you know, so-called as NATO, fighting against the uncivilized East. And we want to say, no, the people of the world, who have an alternative to NATO, which is, in our opinion, socialism, are fighting ISIS. So I learned about Kurdistan when I was there. That's not why I went. A lot of people ask me, are you Kurdish sympathetic, Kurdish family? No, I now support, you know, the Kurdish struggle. But primarily, I went there as a progressive. The Kurdish region.
A lot of people don't know the whole Kurdish thing, though, so it's still worth the.
Of course.
A lot of people aren't going to answer this call, so you might as well tell them what you learned over there.
So, the Kurdish population is spread over four countries: Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. And it has a kind of state in Iraq pretty much since the first Gulf War. They've had a certain kind of independence. And they are pumped full of money by America to be their kind of America's semi-stable base in the region, in Iraq. Nowhere else are they that lucky. In Turkey, they are incredibly persecuted. I'll give you an example. A Kurdish MP was voted in. She gave her swearing-in vow in Kurdish. This was a crime. She was sent to prison, I think, either 7 or 12 years, I can't remember exactly. She came out of prison, she was voted in again, obviously an act of resistance. She swore herself in again in Kurdish and was put back in prison. And that's a minor thing. I mean, hundreds, if not thousands of people died in the last few years in Turkey's attacks on its Kurdish region. And I mean attacks. I mean the same kind of level of violence.
Well, and you
Syria.
Certainly read when, you know, these foreign affairs and military analysts talk about the Kurds sort of being the U.S. attack dogs in that area, that every time the U.S. supports Kurds more, they have problems with Turkey.
Right, yeah.
I mean, Turkey is just livid about anything that that seems to support Kurds, because they're worried about Kurdistan, if you will.
And absolutely.
There's definitely been a strong, I mean, I don't know anything about this, but I do know that there's a very strong nationalist impulse among the Kurds to have their own country in this sort of, you know, nexus of these four different nationalities.
I think nowhere was that stronger than in Turkey until the instability in Syria began.
Right.
Then Turkey had the strongest kind of independence. And I say independence, I don't mean necessarily a state. They want certain rights, they want certain recognitions. And when, as I explained, you can't even speak the language.
A level of autonomy,
you know. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, even this is a threat to the sort of very fabric of the Kurdish state. The Turkish state. The Turkish state is based on the creation of a Turkish people. And it had to stamp on a lot of minority ethnicities and nations to exist in the first place. 20% of the Turkish population are Kurdish and Kurdish speakers. And that's
certainly the classic Armenian problem.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. We're going through some history books now, and we're way over our heads, Mr. Oak. But so when you talk about the brigade, was it you and the rat in your pocket, or there was a bunch of people?
There's a bunch of people. Yeah.
Okay.
So the vast majority here.
Sounds like they must have been for everywhere, if some woman from Germany was sort of a martyr to the cause down there.
Yeah, there were people from Scotland, Ireland. Oh, I'm from England, of course. There were Americans, Canadians. American socialists and anarchists, a member of the Democratic Socialists of America was there, and a bit burnt out by the failure of Bernie.
Very
few of Bernie's supporters said, I'll take up arms in northern Syria. I'll guarantee you that.
You know, perhaps they didn't know they could.
That's very possible. And perhaps, you know, their mothers, lovers, and friends said, what the frick are you thinking of doing? Nobody wants to go near northern Syria, southern Syria, western Syria, or eastern Syria.
You say that. I think the Americans were, out of all the internationals, were the ones who got to it the most easily. They all had some experience with guns. They were like, oh yeah, this gun, I know this gun. Oh, this is, you know, it's a better gun. And I was just like, oh my God, you know, like.
England, you're starting to crack.
Yeah.
That's right, the police still don't have guns. No. The Bobbies don't have guns,
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I bet they do at least know which side points out.
Yeah, so the majority of the battalion, the International Freedom Battalion, it was called, Turkish. They're supported by large Turkish leftist organizations. But they wanted to start this International Freedom Battalion specifically to speak to the international left and to create a meaningful internationalism that says it doesn't matter our, you know, ethnic and national differences, we have the same values. So it's the original socialist internationalism, you know, that really kind of core left-wing value that, you know, this is not a specific struggle to this region, but this is a, you know, a struggle that we're all fighting. And
very important but nostalgic principle for many people.
Yes, absolutely. I think nostalgia is possibly an underused thing in the left, you know.
Maybe, yeah. But
we leave it all to the right to be nostalgic about the good old days. But, yeah.
Well, that's a very good point. We could spend a lot of time on that, and probably fruitfully. So what was it, did we make progress while you were there? I mean, did you feel like y'all were, I don't know, beating ISIS back, mm-hmm. or whatever would be the proper expression here?
Yes, so on campaign, we moved forward, they left, we know, we saw some bodies, we definitely saw them leaving. We took an entire city at the very start, which was Manbij, and then the last phase that I was involved in was the start of the Raqqa operation. And yeah, you know, we took some villages, we moved forward, moved the line forward. Yeah, there were lots of counterattacks by them, but you know, we moved forward. We knew we were taking territory. I think the best thing that I saw was we were stationed most of the time in a town which had been cleared. And this is something that Amnesty International attacked. They said that, you know, the Kurds are ethnically cleansing people out of towns. And we were saying, no, you know, this is a war zone. They have to leave, and I was hoping it was true. I didn't know, but by the time I was leaving, people were coming back. You know, you could go to the shops, the houses were opening up again. People were rebuilding their lives, and so the refugees were actually returning. And so, if you live in Europe,
the Kurds were not stopping them.
No, absolutely not. No.
So that puts point to that.
Yeah, and the battalions themselves, the Kurdish battalions, had a mixture of Arabs and Kurdish people. Increasingly, they were Arabs fighting with them, and specific Arab battalions and Arab leaders and so on and so forth. So, you know, they were doing what they said they were doing. But yeah, to see refugees returning is quite important for someone coming from Europe, which is experiencing a so-called refugee crisis. And the idea that you're actually kind of partly solving that is very reassuring.
Well, absolutely. And obviously, it must have been a serious decision to put yourself in harm's way.
It was, and I made it twice. You see, the first thing I did is actually I joined a workers' brigade for the reconstruction of Kobani, which was famously the last stand of the Kurds that no one expected them to win.
Now, where is Kobani? Yes.
Kobani is on the border of Turkey, and okay. It was very famous, infamous, that Turkey was stopping Kurdish people going from Turkey to fight in Kobani, but turning a blind eye to Islamist volunteers going to join ISIS, crossing the border the other way.
And people were crossing the border illegally?
Yes, yeah. But, you know, Turkey was shooting at Kurdish people trying to get to Kobani to defend it, but turning a blind eye to Islamist volunteers joining ISIS, and this was caught on tape, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they just tough it out. They're in a position where they're a NATO member, and they're also saying, you know, if you don't play ball with us, Europe will flood Europe with, you know, all the refugees that we're currently stopping from leaving Turkey from Syria. So the first time I went over the border from Turkey, and I helped in the reconstruction of Kobani, and I came back, and this fooled my family and my partner into thinking, you know, he's gone once, it was all right. The second time, I went to fight, so it was different. But yeah, so that's kind of what made it less of a scary thing for those close to me, is I'd done it once and come back, so I was able to.
So you knew a little bit about what was on the ground.
I knew that it was a real revolution from the first time I was there. I was able to speak to the people, I was able to pick up the atmosphere. You know, I think you can tell quite easily if something is just, say, like a military coup. You know, the people are uneasy about talking about who's in charge. They're not sure. But in this, it was clearly, at the very least, a genuine national liberation. People were saying, yeah, my whole city is destroyed, but I'm so happy to be able to celebrate my culture, speak my language, and to practice our political beliefs, which they, you know, wanted to practice for a long time, which is things
like...
Did
you know Kurdish at all, or you learned a little in the Workers' Brigade, or...?
In the Workers' Brigade, we learned very little.
That's not a common subject in the English curriculum,
no.
I bet.
No, not at all. I mean, it was hard to find any guys to learn in Kurdish. They're starting to be... As people become interested in this revolution in Rojava, people are digging out guys to learning it. It was the second time we got a month's training in learning Kurdish. When we did this simultaneously as a month's training in ideology, the ideology of their political movement, and other things as well. So it wasn't, I can't say like I had a month's solid Kurdish. It was like maybe a couple of weeks.
But we're talking to Gary Oak, who is from London, but just spent two tours, we'll call it, in northern Syria, and working alongside an international brigade with the Kurdish people. Now, one of the things we talked about earlier is they're trying some fairly interesting...
Political things, yeah.
Yeah, some political experiences, experiments, I guess, that might be worth talking about. So give me a sense of some of... we talked about this yesterday.
So formally, the party in charge is the PYD. And they are—they say they're the compass or the vanguard of the area, and they keep control of it in the formal sense. But underneath that, that's made up of an umbrella organization called the Democratic Society Movement, which in Kurdish is called Tevdem. And that's made up of communes, which is their name for it. They're called communes in Kurdish. And the communes are based at a neighborhood level. There could be a bunch of streets together. They're based in workplace levels. They say, like, the taxi driver's commune. They now start to call it a union. They understand to translate it to say union. But there's communes also, the women's communes as well, which are regional. And then there's the other thing which they're attempting to, which is workers' cooperatives. So I've seen a cooperative bakery. I've seen a cooperative factory. Industry is pretty small scale. It's not a developed part of Syria, which I think is one of the reasons why they've been able to do this, is it's a largely ignored part that Assad was quite happy, well, wasn't happy, but he was happy to focus on other areas rather than spend any time trying to fight to get back this.
So how do the communes work? I mean, is there a democratic practice, or is there...
Yes, yeah, you know, one person, one vote, and a lot of kind of debating and meeting. There's a lot of leadership in it, though. It would be wrong to say that, you know, you can just throw this at people and expect them to work for it. There's a lot of leadership. So people will explain the things to the people, then they will vote, you know. And they will organise so that people attend the commune. So as part of my work for a couple of months was I was working as something part of the liaison committee, which was called the SYPG, Say Up Again, which is... encouraging the different ethnicities to come and take their place on councils. So, for instance, you have a council which has Arabs, Syriac Christians, other religious and ethnic minorities, and they all have a guaranteed place. It's not done on the size of their community. If there was like seven Jews in Rojava, the Jews would have one place on a certain council.
So there's a form of, in the US they would call affirmative action.
Absolutely. Yeah. The most impressive affirmative action is for women. Every leadership position has to have one man and one woman. So any leadership position in their party has one man and one woman. And there's definitely a lot of affirmative action. Positive, we call it positive discrimination in, say, the leadership in our Tabor. Most of the time it was a woman. Different women were given the commander position of our battalion.
Well, I think sometimes that's surprising to people when you see pictures of the Kurdish part of the battle, is that women fighters are very common in the
It was just one of the major reasons as well, because, you know, we have spent a long time looking at the women's struggle again in the last few years in Europe and America, certainly, and a lot of us have been asking ourselves, you know, what is the right path and to see its own organic uprising against some of the most harsh patriarchal, let's say it, the most harsh patriarchal oppression of women, I think, in the world, has to be ISIS. And to see that the people of that region are leading the fight against it, you just got to go and support that. You've got to.
It's certainly not the stereotypical way in which people see the Muslim community.
Absolutely not.
So no. To have a, you know, a section of this community make such an affirmative stance about one man, one woman in terms of governance and many social affairs, that must be interesting.
I mean, also,
where are they going with all this? Are they going to have a chance to build that kind of practice there if the war abates at all, or if they can push ISIS out? Or?
Actually, I would say the war is probably helping them right now. You know, as soon as there's peace, there's going to be some serious questions asked about who's going to be running that officially. Assad does want formal control of it back. He sent an election team there to run an election, and they said,
when
no.
When you say Assad, you're talking about the other side of the civil war.
Yes, So he let this region go relatively peacefully, but you know, he does want it back if he can have it back, and so they're going to have to come to some sort of deal. But I'm relatively optimistic because the structures they've set up, as I say, there's this Compass Party, Vanguard Party, the PYD, and then there was all their structures are below that. They're bottom-up sort of grassroots projects. I don't see it makes a huge amount of difference who's in power. I mean, as long as, you know, someone doesn't then spend a huge amount of time trying to destroy these things, and I don't think Assad will be in a particularly strong position to do so. I think those structures will continue to build and inspire people and hopefully kind of gradually build up their power.
So there was still an international brigade after you left, I'm sure.
Yes, it's growing. It's absolutely growing. You know, international support.
It can't be easy to get into Syria to join this brigade.
No, but the movement is incredibly well organized. It's organized in all the countries around. It's been, you know, the regional left is something that you wouldn't believe until you experience it. You know, they have their structures and organizations across the Middle East. And once you're in, once they trust you, they can move mountains, or rather move you over mountains.
Certainly when you talk about Americans or even Canadians that are going to join the brigade, they're not getting their passport stamped from Toronto or New York as they leave to head for Syria.
No, yeah.
So it can't be easy to, you know, just sort of stroll in and say, I'm ready, sign me up.
Oh, there's a will, where there's a will, there's a way.
I'm sure. This is sort of opposite migrants or something. They find their way down there. So this seems like it was sort of a world-changing experience for you.
It was a world-confirming. It confirmed my, you know, long-held opinions that I'd hoped to have a chance to confirm, you know, the universal values of socialism, the universal values, you know, of the women's struggle, of feminism, that what we were told for the last 30, 40 years increasingly, that, you know, that there are not universal values, that people experience things differently. We've had a real kind of experience of postmodernism, especially on the left. I would call it the postmodern malaise. Everyone experiences things differently. You know, it's all about your experience. You know, there are no great uniting values, and this has just smashed that for me. And I think for everyone.
And ISIS is a worthy opponent as well. That seems to be part of your conclusion.
Yes, definitely. But I mean, all opponents of the Rashar revolution, you know, shouldn't stop with ISIS. The idea that you have ethical values strong enough to risk and sacrifice your life to is something that the left is starting to regain. And I think that's what we need to have to see more of to really inspire people to take those kinds of risks. Not just in big things like this, but we always try to make a link that, you know, we've had an opportunity almost because of a lack of family or other pressures to do this. But our real inspiration is the day-to-day people, you know, trade unionists, community organisers, who are just as heroic. And we always said, you know, we see ourselves as normal people and we connect ourselves to the struggles of normal people back home, rather than being like, you know, the international superheroes.
Well, I'm sure it's still illegal in the United States where this show is being broadcast to recruit for, you know, people to be involved in an armed conflict in another country. So categorically we're not doing that, but we are talking to one of the most interesting people in the world, which is the mandate of Wage World. Now, if people have more questions about this, you know, Muslim divisions, the Kurds, what their struggle is about, the kind of democracy they're trying to build or anything, is there a website or a way that they can get in touch with Gary Oak and find out more about this?
You can't get in touch with me. If you want to read some of the things I've written, you can Google Gary Oak Rojava and it'll come up with a few articles.
Spell Rojava.
R-O-J-A-V-A.
Okay.
And the International Freedom Battalion has a Facebook page. If you search International Freedom Battalion or you go to Facebook/International Freedom, you'll find it. And I think that's quite active. I think they've got people answering
Thank
questions.
You, Gary Oak. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. This show definitely qualifies there. We say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, and we'll have another guest. This is Wade Rathke from Wage World. Thank you.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.